Thanks everyone for coming. Today we have Simon Kaufman telling us about, from IAS, telling us about a new trigger for a CMS upgrade.
Yeah, so thanks. So this is a little study I've done last year with Yuri Gerstein and Rutgers, trying to see if there's some way of looking for displaced vertices with muons at after the phase two upgrade, the CMS track trigger and the phase two upgrade. So it's going to be somewhat shorter than your usual seminar, I think, and perhaps for some of the CMS folks it might be elementary, but so feel free to ask whatever questions and so on, and we should have plenty of time. All right, anyway, so this is basically, I'm just going to motivate the things a little quickly why this is something that's interesting now. I'll make a quick detour past CodeXP, some experimental effort that I'm tangentially involved in, and then I'll talk about the actual thing. So just a heads up that there is a little detour coming up at some point. All right, so things are working well, so CMS folks, of course, know. But for those of you who don't think about colliders on a daily basis, so we're about 200 imperfect barn on tape. So this is where we're for the Higgs, this is where we're now. Talking about roughly a pileup of 40 right now, it's going to go up to 200 or more at the high luminosity LHC. And so a lot of what we need to think about is how to deal with these pileup levels. So on the analysis side, so these are a few things that are catching my eyes these days and what people are thinking about in terms of analysis. So of course, very interested in any sort of precision Higgs measurements. People are trying to do these very difficult HCC bar and H2 mu and so on. And for BSM studies, more complicated hadronic final states are being more and more explored, and there's some effort on the theory and experimental side to do some machine learning for these things. And then there's a long wave particles and a push towards soft physics with some of these tricks. And so the things that I will touch on today are these two aspects over here. And so our experimental friends are working very hard on the upgrade, and so the main things that have caught my eye on this is the 40 megahertz tracking that will be implemented in CMS, so the timing detectors, more hermetic trackers, and so on. The main motivation for these things is pileup mitigation at the high luminosity LHC. What we'd like to try to understand on the theory side, what are some of these features are we can use to look more effectively for new physics, especially soft new physics, that don't pass your traditional triggers and so on. So this is an example as to why I think this might be of use. So if you just count before cuts or anything like that, the number of beam mesons that you're making at the LHC, and you compare that with, for instance, Bell 2. This is the final data set of Bell 2, more or less. So you find you have roughly 4 to 5 orders of magnitude more beams at Atlas and CMS. Of course, most of these you won't record necessarily, but there are certain special cases where you might be able to do better than in Bell. And so this is something that we need to think about. So LHCb is about a factor of 10 less luminosity, and I put in a factor of 3 penalty for the geometric acceptance because they only have half detector. And so the example is what I had on the first slide is B2S mu mu. We have the very nice muon final state, which you can do very nicely in hadron machines as well. And so the sort of broader question that I think is useful to think about these days is what types of like traditionally intensity frontier physics can you try doing at Atlas and CMS leveraging some of these very large cross sections. And so for this you need these sort of non-traditional tools, like you need special data runs maybe, like the data scout and the other parking techniques, or like try to come up with some innovative trigger strategies. So one example of the special runs that's sort of close to my heart is the heavy ion runs, where you can do light-by-light scattering. So this is some very beautiful measurements that Atlas and CMS have done last year, or the year before last year. We collide heavy ions, but very often the ions just pass by each other in the beam pipe. But because they're like ionized, they're 82 plus electric charge, they have very huge electromagnetic fields associated with them. And so you can basically collide, they come with a cloud of photons that you can collide, and you can produce two back-to-back photons that we're seeing over here, which is only you can do in a very, very high energy ion beam. And so they observe this process, and so now they have what, like you have about 2 inverse nanobarn worth of happy ion data, and you see it's very clear access. And so something that Tung Yeon and I worked on many years ago is you can use this to look for axion-like particles. So if you have a particle that couples just to photons, you can produce it on shell resonantly, and it decays back to photons. You can do a bump hunt on this sort of thing, which is what CMS has done last year. And so you see this is the limit where you you can set the best limit just with heavy ion collisions. So this is one example where in this mass range around 5 to 10 GeV, you might expect that for this type of particle, an experiment like Bell 2 would be, or Babar would be the most powerful, or even LEP. But you can set competitive limits with the LHC if you have this sort of spectrum.
So the Bell limits, are they on here too, or?
The Bell limits are not on here. Well, so there's no existing Bell 2 limits yet, right? So they're just getting started. But like the projections, I believe, are they will go somewhere. Yeah, well, obviously they stop at 10 GeV, but they'll somewhere like in a 10 to minus 4 regime in this normalization.
Let me understand, you do lead versus PPs because you get big magnetic fields.
Correct. Yeah. So you can do the same thing.
Like Z squared or Z to the fourth.
Right? Z to the fourth, yeah. So actually, you can do the same thing with PP. And so that's what this black line is here. It's not competitive, but just for to guide your eye. So there's also a CMS.
Where was that done?
This was done in, I think, 2015. I don't remember. I mean, this is a relatively small data set, though.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But this is, I don't quite remember. Do you remember what trigger they used for this one? There was some, I think it was done actually in a low pilot data set. I don't know that you can do this in a full data set.
Is it diphoton masses?
This is the mass, the diphoton invariant mass. So the same thing that's plotted over here corresponds to the mass of the action-like particle in this case. Yeah, so now I remember, I think this was done on the ADM versus Picobarn data set with like pile above, average pile above one.
I mean, there is of course, the gamma spectrum easily goes to 100 GeV and go lower.
Yeah, so that's what these other constraints are. So these are, I don't know if they're...
No, I'm talking about Atlas and CMS with full statistics.
Right. Yeah, so you can do...
There is an Atlas 2 gamma 1 that goes down quite a bit further. It must just be that CMS only has a small luminosity, but Atlas has it all.
Ah, you mean for this one?
Yeah, it's over on the right. It looks like there is an Atlas PG to 2 gammas. Yeah.
Yes.
The CMS one is from the coherent.
Yeah, so that's right. So this is the exclusive production. So this is where you know that both protons didn't break up. So that's a direct analog with the heavy ion one. And so it's somewhat of a curiosity. I mean, it's not competitive, right? So if you do proton-proton, then you want to do you don't mind breaking up the protons. You do associated production, actually. So you do, there you would be looking for, so this is the three-photon surge, which is the most competitive. In the low-mass region.
Sorry, what's recording is that diphoton? Is that another
photon? This is another photon, yeah.
Triphoton.
That's right. So that's what these are. That's what this yellow blob is over here. Okay. So that's the best search if you want to use proton-proton collisions.
And CMS simply hasn't done that, apparently. Looks like you.
Possible. I'm sure you have. Yeah, so this was our I think what they just used our recast at the time from the which was Atlas data at the time, and we wrote this in 2016. So if we
have a triphoton trigger?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I think the diphoton is...
So that diphoton goes down to about 70 or 80.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, the threshold.
Yeah, but with a triphoton, you can go
lower, yeah. Yeah, so it might be, these limits might be subject to improvement. I think they're somewhat, to make this plot, they just used our recast from 2016. So that's by now probably outdated.
And it all decays promptly here.
Yes, yeah. And so this one, in some, even like, it has very, very small transverse momentum. So it's basically in the transverse plane, it's at rest. Because otherwise it would break the ions and you would just have a bunch of other crap in the detector and you would know they didn't have exclusive collision. Anyway, so I just want to mention this.
We don't have a triphoton trigger, that'll put one in.
Yeah. So see, something good already came from this talk. Okay, great. Even if the rest is not interesting.
Sorry, Simon, the lower limit on the 2-photon and the 3-photon, that's just set by the minimum BT of the...
You mean this one or the...
Yeah, for any of the plots.
Yeah, so here you start being limited by the 2-photon start. If the mass of this guy becomes very light, they start merging. Yeah. And it becomes a bit of a problem. You have much more background and it's not so easily resolved. This over here is set by the trigger threshold. So the trigger threshold was 2 GeV per photon, which is somewhat absurdly low, but like you can do that in heavy ions because it's a 2 GeV per photon plus a veto on the end cap. So like, so there's a veto on any activity in the end caps, which tells you that you didn't have an ion breaking up.
So what if what stops you from making that figure any lower? Like,
I move the bound. Well, my experimental colleagues can comment, but like my understanding is that the 2 GeV is roughly what the noise threshold of the colorimeter is. So that was what we were told at the time. Is that accurate or?
Yeah, 2 GeV is really low.
That's very low, yeah. I mean, this is a very special calibration, special trigger depth that we're doing for heavy ions. You would never be able to do anything remotely like this at a PP RAM.
The associated production, if you use a single photon trigger, then I guess you could trigger on the thing that was recently canceled.
Yeah, you can trigger on this thing. And there exist studies like this, right? So the issue tends to be that for low masses, if you make this one very hard, it starts to merge. And so one thing that I think could be of interest is if we can start looking for substructure. Now, the problem is, as you know very well, that there's pi zeros. There's a lot of them, and they do exactly this. Right? So if there's a variable that you use to discriminate efficiently from pi zeros. So one thing that I've been hoping to look at and haven't yet is conversions. Right? So if you can convert some of these photons in the tracker, you pay a penalty, but now you have better vertexing in some sense, and maybe there's something you can do. Especially if this thing is slightly long-lived.
But the single photon trigger is like right now. It was like 200 GeV or something.
Yes, it's very high. Yeah.
It's very high.
But only at HLT, even at level one, it's lower, right?
Yeah, well, you're thinking about fit, I see fancy triggers. I'm thinking of next year.
We can do photon scouting in one year.
Yeah, because the one thing that I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a fairly large hierarchy between the level one threshold and the HLT threshold. So something that I've been hoping to look at is if there's some variable at HLT you could implement to find basically build a photon jet trigger of some sort to bypass that extra high trigger threshold. I don't know the answer. It's something we could talk about. Something like this has been done, a study for LACB, though. Check and let you know. It can give you the reference if you want. All right, anyways, I'm not talking about any of this, but just for the theorists in the audience and telling you some of the other neat ideas that are happening, mostly in CMS, actually. So Atlas is being a little bit behind on this, I think. So this is the idea of data scouting, where instead of writing out the whole event, you're stripping down the event to a very small format, so you're throwing away a lot of the information. So more or less, I think, 4 vectors of particles and some isolation information. So it reduces the size of the event to about 10 kilobyte, which you read out with like about 5 kilohertz, which is roughly comparable to the total readout rate of the entire trigger. So that's pretty cool. And so that means that you can have these very low thresholds in this sort of more minimal data set compared to the regular dimuon thresholds. And so this is a very nice spectrum where you see all the mesons. This is obtained at the HLT trigger level. And then there is this fascinating data parking idea where basically, typically the events are, once they're read out, they're immediately reconstructed. And so the bottleneck is one of the bottlenecks is the offline event reconstruction. So the data parking is a special stream where you store the data for a while and you try to reconstruct this data set in LHC downtime when the farms are not as occupied. And so that also allows you to look at lower threshold as a separate set. So I think CMS now has recorded by 10 to the 10 B mesons using this thing, which is the same as roughly as the total Babar data set. So that's nothing to sneeze at. I mean, there's some cool physics you can do with that. Anyways. So what I'll be talking about, as I told you, I was going to look at displaced dimuon resonances, and so I'm looking at his benchmark model. And so the benchmark model is really just a light scaler that couples the Higgs in this way. So this is, and if you want, the most minimal extension of the standard model that you could do, you just add one scalar field. You turn on one coupling, which is this one. You can also turn on this one, which increases the rate and also gives you exotic Higgs decays. But so for this talk, I'm going to be conservative, only turn on this one, just to study that. The production of this type of particle, if it's below the BMOS, is predominantly through this electroweak penguin. So this was computed slightly before I was born. And so this is the thing that's been very well studied. So we know what this is. It's roughly this sine theta is the mixing angle between the scalar and the Higgs. So that's in some sense the coupling constant that we're going to be caring about. It also determines the lifetime of this thing. So the decay of this gadget is, this is very well understood theoretically. The decay is a huge mess because this thing picks up a coupling to gluons because it mixes with the Higgs. And so then it maps onto all the standard model hadrons in some very complicated way. And so none of these things are not always completely calculable. In this low mass regime, you use chiral perturbation theory. It works fine. Here you have QCD is roughly perturbative, so you can also do something. And here in the middle, you either interpolate or you use dispersion relations. So the theory uncertainties here are very large. So you see a bunch of resonances here. So this is basically the F0 that you start seeing. For what we care about, it's a little hard to see maybe with the colors, but this line over here is the partial width to muons. So that means that roughly in most of the mass range, the dimuon branching ratio for this thing is somewhere between a few percent and 10% or so. So it's not huge, but you prefer muons over pions or something like that. So it's not bad. So that's the type of benchmark model that we're looking at. So LACB has searched for this thing. And so what they're doing, what they're very good at, is reconstructing exclusive decay chains, right? So they look for a B or B plus associated with a K or K on or K star. And so they insist on reconstructing the entire chain. So they reconstruct the vertex for the B, and then they reconstruct the additional vertex for the phi, where they do insist on reconstructing both the associated kaons, right? And so that gives them a lot of power to reject backgrounds. But of course, it comes at a price in signal acceptance. So this...
calculate the exclusive branching ratios?
Yeah, so there exist. Yeah, so I showed you the inclusive ones. There also exist exclusive calculations. The theory uncertainties in these are much larger. But yeah, so they use the exclusive branching ratios. And so that comes with some inherent uncertainty.
By larger, you mean like 50%? And
they're like order one on uncertainties. Yeah, these hadronic matrix elements are, yeah, they are what they are.
So are you saying that in this kinematic regime, this production channel is the dominant production channel for the scalar?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can also make it in fragmentation, right? It couples the gluon, so instead of a pion, maybe you fragment one of these things. But you can estimate that you can't compute it, but you can estimate that that's subdominant to this.
Right.
If you have axion-like particles instead, then this story changes. That's something we can discuss as well. But then you make them in the shower, because you didn't split them off of hard gluons. But for this type of model, the B mesons are your best bet. If you're very low mass, then you can get them from kaons too, and N62 and so on.
For example, Higgs conversion into phi, where you have Higgs, this is much smaller?
Oh, Higgs decaying to, yes, that's much smaller. I mean, that relies on the Higgs triplet coupling, right, in this case.
Right. Well, does it?
Well, so I only turned on this thing. So there's different couplings you can turn on. So I only turned on this, right? So if I turn on this thing as well, now I just have Higgs decaying directly to phi phi, and so that's very nice. So that's another thing you can do.
But if you have the first term, you can have one Higgs. One Higgs can get a bit of right, and then.
Yeah, but it's still just a mass mixing, right?
Right.
That's not a.
Sure.
You can do associated production, but then that's really, really small. Was there a question? So they reconstruct these decay chains, and so they specifically for this search over here, they have these three lifetime bins that they're making. So they like to plot things in terms of picoseconds. And so, the colors are kind of gone. But so this over here is the prompt lifetime bin. This little hair on the bottom over here is the displaced lifetime bin. And the very displaced lifetime bin, they didn't see any events. And they can set limits with this, which is what this looks like. So you ignore all this colored stuff. This is very model dependent. This just depends on what you want to do with this model. But these are the limits from LACB. And as you see there, graphics department is not as well staffed as the one in CMS and Atlas. So these are these two different searches. So the K-star one and the K1 one. So it's really not bad. I mean, it's very nice reach. So basically what happens is, so they're probing branching ratios. This is roughly maps to the branching ratios. It's only a 10 to the minus 7-ish, right? Well, they had 10 to the 12 Bs on tape or something along those lines. So you can see from this that even though they're basically background free, they paid a very large penalty in terms of event reconstruction, partially because their detector is shaped the way it is, and because they put a lot of cuts in order to make this very pure.
This is all prompt?
This limit combines all these three bins, but the limit here is basically driven by the displaced bin. So if you're over here, then you're prompt, of course, right? And so then, yeah. But then the rate is so large that, you know, the thing would just stand out like.
When they define these time bins, so is that just the displacement divided by C, or how is that defined?
Yeah, so this is defined as the time in the lab frame. So yeah, the displacement defined, the side divided by C.
Okay.
Yeah. It's lab frame, not rest frame. Yeah.
So just one more question. Like, since, I mean, you're assuming you have this mu phi x dagger h coupling, but not the quartic coupling.
Right.
But of course, if you have the trilinear coupling, there's some level at which you're going to generate the quartic coupling too, right?
Sure, but I mean, that's a loop. If there's a small parameter, and now you're going to make a box of that, and it's going to be really tiny, right?
I mean, it would be like mu squared over mx squared, I guess.
Right, but mu is a very, very small parameter here, right? Mu over mh is like 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7.
Okay. I don't think you wrote a number for mu, like, so I'm not sure how. But you're thinking that the thing to be.
Yeah. So basically, roughly speaking, this the sine theta is the mixing angle, right? This is just going to be mu over the x half, right? And so they're probing things
right.
The order of 10 to the minus. This is the square, so this 10 to the minus 3.
Okay. Right.
So you're talking about something below a GV for this. So if you want to generate the quartic, this is going to be this to the fourth.
Yeah,
and
right.
So that's just, you know, completely negligible. All right, very good. Any more questions about LACB? This is one of the things that motivated us for this Codex B proposal that we've had, which some of you may have heard of, is a way of extending LACB's reach for these long lifetimes because the velo is fairly small. So what you're seeing here is the LACB cavern. This is the interaction point. The beamline goes over here, and this triangle thing over here is the LACB. This is the corpse of the Delphi detector, and this is the data racks of LACB in the current run. Now, so they're currently, as we speak, they're moving this stuff to the surface, so there is some space that will be available. And so the idea is to just put a detector over here, and then shield it with a block of a hadron absorber to ensure that. The shadow of this block does not have any standard model hadrons that got untagged. So you can get a more or less background-free setup. This is the model anyway, and so this is what you could do with this type of detector. This is the search that I just showed you, and this is a generous extrapolation, what that would be at the high luminosity LHC. So you can add this extra region, and you can compare that with Ship and Methuselah, which have quite a bit better reach, but are much, much more large and expensive.
What about phaser?
Oh, sorry. Phaser somehow got omitted on this plot, but phaser lives over here.
Okay.
Yeah. So they overlap a little bit with Codex B, and they overlap quite a bit with the future LACB run. This is phaser 2, which is the upgrade. Phaser 1 has no reach for this. The current version of phaser has no reach in this mouse plate. The upgrade would have some nice reach.
should we look, we should probably see if Mili, you know what I'm saying? If Mili can demonstrate to us that it may have some sensitivity.
Yeah, it's too small, I think.
Yeah, it's, and the backgrounds are, it's really not designed to suppress the backgrounds. To be able to tell that you have two
neons.
Yeah, you need a tracker.
Yeah, I think we checked Millikan at some point, but it's just the solid angle is fairly small. And so here you also, you need a sort of large volume, right?
So if you go back to your design, pretty much your solid angle is defined by the space you can put, how big of a detector you can put in that space.
So we have 10 by 10 by 10 meters in principle. If we manage to remove Delphi, we have twice as much, but that's logistically very challenging.
You have twice as much this way?
In this direction, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I see, yeah. Could you also just go closer? I mean, how much of that wall is shielding that extra year?
This is 3 meters worth of concrete. Going closer would be great, but they're not, LHCB is understandably not excited about that.
Right.
I mean, they'd like to be able to access, you know, this thing, which is, you know, very important for them. So this is like, yeah, this is what we can get away with maybe. There are proposals. There's a proposal now that you may hear about soon. Something that there's the modal people that sit over here, right? And so they want to build something in a forward tunnel, which is a bit smaller, a bit more forward. So their B rate, it's the rate is roughly comparable to this, but like we're concerned about backgrounds because there you're shielded by rock, which there's quite a bit of rock. But like what we need in order to be background free is an active muon vitor in this thing. So you have a lot of muons downstream that create more backgrounds. If you don't have that, you have trouble believing that you're seeing what you're seeing. So, but maybe they can solve that problem, and then there's an alternative to this. All right, we did many other models, which I will not entertain you with unless you ask me later. We recently published our expression of interest, which is sort of stage one of like the many things that you need to publish for building a detector. And all of these models are in there. So we have some dark matter stuff, some heavy neutral leptons, you can do Higgs decays, and so on. Going forward, so yeah, I just mentioned we finished this expression of interest. And so right now, our colleagues on the experimental side are working on finalizing a demonstrator detector. So this would be a small version of the thing, which is a 2 by 2 by 2 meter object which would go into the cavern. And so with no additional shielding other than just the wall that exists. And so the main thing for this is to calibrate our background simulations and to test out the event reconstruction and so on and so on. So we're working on the design of this thing. The design is more or less ready, and we're working through the approval process of installing this thing. We're working on a letter of intent, and so we're aiming for some sort of hybrid collaboration where we would be partially tied to LECB, but not that we could also have external members. So we have some people from Atlas, for instance, who are doing the RPC stuff. Because LECB does not have RPCs, as it turns out, so you need some. This is our very tentative timeline. The main thing that is true about this in some metaphysical sense is the demonstrator part. So this, we think, is this is what we want to do in the near future. And then the rest is a bit more fluid. Like one of the main advantages that we have is that this cavern is accessible even when there's beam. There's enough shielding, so if they don't manage to install the thing before the beam turns on, we're not necessarily dead. All right. Anyways, I promised to talk about CMS, so let me do that. This was all just some. Here's some numbers. This is all obvious for the CMS folks, but maybe for the theorists who don't think about triggers on a daily basis. These are the triggers always exist in two stages, level one and high level trigger. And the numbers that I'm quoting here are what I got from the CMS TDR for phase two, so they're a bit different now. So you always start with 40 megahertz, that's just the current collision rate. And at level one, you're looking to get this down to a rate of 750 kilohertz, and eventually the full rate out to offline is about 7.5 kilohertz. So if you want to put in some new trigger and you don't want people to be really mad at you, something, you know, these are like ballpark numbers that you're hoping to achieve, right? So if you're putting in something that at level one creates a rate of roughly some kilohertz, you might not get yelled at too much. Maybe it's possible. And then at HLT, you need to be at a hertz or so that it's a negligible fraction of the total budget. And so what I'm going to talk about today is we're going to try to do this step using the CMS track trigger. This is what the tracker will look like in phase two. So you have these four inner layers. They are only available at HLT. There is no time bandwidth to read them out at level one. But these six layers over here will be available at level one. So that's a major innovation compared to what's happening right now. The other major innovation is that there will be a tracker all the way down to ETA 4, while right now it's more like 2.4 or so. And so the way this works is that for these layers over here in the center and the outer layers, every layer is really a double layer, so you have about 100 micron pixel sizes, and there's two layers slightly separated from each other. And they're on the same chip, so that means if a track passes through, it can compute the pitch between these two layers, and it can make a rudimentary estimate of the momentum of this track. So this would be a high momentum track, and this would be a low momentum track because it bends in the B field. And so this helps you already at the level of these PT modules to reduce the combinatorics, throw away a bunch of hits which you know are coming from soft tracks, and that makes it computationally viable to fit tracks through the remaining hits at the level one. Is there anything I'm omitting that's particularly important for this? Or that's sort of my theorist level understanding on how this is going to work. Now, so what Yuri figured out in 2017 is that this setup actually also, in principle, can work for displaced tracks, right? So if I have a track with an impact parameter that's not too large, so this is the primary interaction point, it's the beamline and the transverse plane, and there's a track coming like this. So these are prompt tracks, right? So if the track were prompt, it needs to lay, if there's a hit over here, it needs to be a second hit in this interval. But some of these displaced tracks may still pass this trigger, while if pass this cut on the stops. While if your impact parameter is very large, you would miss it, and so then you're not reconstructed. And so he's using that to show that you can maybe reconstruct displaced tracks as well. And this is really just a picture of what a track looks like, just some notation for the theory folks again. When I say D0 in the rest of the talk, I really mean, so this is a track, so if you extrapolate the circle of the track in a transverse plane, D0 is always the impact parameter to the beam axis of the point of closest approach. So that's one of the important variables to look at tracks. So here, Yuri assumed that if you can fit the tracks, not constraining them to pass through the beam line, then you have fairly nice acceptance. So this, my understanding, is not part of the baseline CMS design. So this would require some additional, significant additional investment. And so part of the study that we're trying to do is to understand, if you were to do this, what gain do you get, and is this something that's worthwhile. So for the study that we're doing now, the pixel resolution is included, and so we also included the slight deflections of the tracks in the interior layers from multiple scattering, because we're going to reconstruct vertices, and so we need to make sure that we're not overestimating our reach here. So this is included in the simulation.
Do I understand right that you basically have an upper PT cut in this, in that if it's displaced and high PT, it won't look like it's high PT and not displaced?
Right. Yeah. So if it's
about what is that upper PT cut?
I have a plot in later here. So that's right. So if it's very, very hard but very, very displaced, it would still look like it was very soft. That's what you're saying, right? Yes, that's right. I think maybe, yeah, this is the slide maybe that will answer that question. So this is, the colors are a little bit bad, but when it's dark, you have very good efficiency. When it's yellow, you don't, right? And so this is PT versus this impact parameter, right? And so like what you're saying is like, if you have, suppose you have a fairly hard track, like 6 GeV, but your impact parameter is very, very large, you start losing as well, right? And so this is sort of the sweet spot of what you could do. This is with 4 stops. If you require 5 stops, then, you know, of course, especially on the lifetime side, you start losing a little bit because you need an additional layer. You can't be as displaced as you otherwise would be. So it worked reasonably well. And so the study that Yuri did and that was made official with the CMS pass is to use this to tag jets as being displaced. So you just reconstruct jets from, like, let's say, a Higgs decay, and you ask that there are a couple of displaced tracks inside this jet, and then you use that to lower the HD threshold for that type of trigger. And so that seems to work fairly well, and that's quite interesting.
Sorry, I'm puzzled by one thing. I would have thought that the highest efficiency you could get would be 50% for a given track, because if it's displaced in a certain direction, it has to have the right charge, basically PT. PT to be headed in the direction that compensates for its impact parameter. And so half of them will be pointed the wrong way.
Let's see. Yeah, but this is...
But it depends on the DCO.
Yeah, I think the D0 also has a sign here, right? So
of D0, I would think half of them point in a way that compensates for it and half don't. It may be that what you're doing is just asking, you're asking four or more stubs where eventually it's going to line up in a few layers.
Yeah. So this is already making a track. It's not per stub. This is for a track. Yes.
That's and right. You need four out of seven or something like that. I don't remember.
Good. And then you can put additional requirements that you don't want any holes if you want and so on. But like we didn't do that.
What happens above 5 centimeters? It's just zero.
It falls off fairly fast after this. Yeah.
Even for IPTs?
It falls less fast, but it still falls fairly fast. And again, this is what's important is that this is under the assumption that there is no constraint to the beamline. If you constrain this to the beamline, it still works, but like it's a lot less good. All right, so then what we set out to do is vertex reconstruction. This is quite boring, but just to, at the very least, define some notation. So we have two helix, the two muons. And so we're trying to basically first try to intersect the two circles in the transverse plane. If you find an intersection, you always find two. And then we set this variable delta t to zero. And then for those two intersection points, we compute how far the tracks were apart from each other in the z direction. That's this variable delta z. So that's a measurement of what the quality of the vertex is, right? If that's very large, you had a very bad vertex. If it's small, you had a good vertex. And of these two solutions, we always pick the one which has the smallest delta z. One of them will be very large, one of them will be pretty small.
And this is still a level one in hardware?
This would have to be in level one hardware, yeah. So this is why, in some sense, it's a very silly. Yeah, it's a very crude. Well, it's also crude because of my poor coding abilities, but the excuse is that for level one, it's also, you don't want to do some optimization or anything like that if you can avoid it. If you're unlucky and they don't intersect, you just find the point of closest approach in the transverse plane. You call that the vertex, and then there's this extra variable delta t, which again measures the quality of the track. The vertex.
This is something that you would code inside an FPGA.
That's what you would try to do here.
So when you wrote the algorithm, you were thinking about what's possible in an FPGA.
Not explicitly. No. I wrote just to make this work, and then you might have to optimize this for.
But then, some expert will tell you that yes, this can be done in an FPGA.
Yeah. So Yuri, Yuri seems to think that this might be possible, but I only know the acronym of FPGA, but that's as far as my knowledge goes. I'm only a poor theorist. This is aspirational in that sense. We hope that this could be done. All right, so this is some performance plots, what this looks like if you're reconstructing tracks. So we just put some vertices and some, this is just for tracks. This is the impact parameter minus the true impact, the measured impact parameter minus the reconstructed impact parameter minus the true impact parameter. And you see this is just with resolution, and the blue is if you also add multiple scattering. And so this is just to show that the multiple scattering matters for this. And this is the same for the vertex radius. So RT is the radius of the vertex in the detector. And so you see it's actually fairly poor, right? So the resolution is fairly bad. It's about a centimeter. And that's just because the first layer that you get is about 30 centimeters out, and so you're extrapolating these tracks fairly far. They're also fairly collimated, so you expect not a fantastic resolution. Again, multiple scattering matters here. And so this will be important for beam-eson backgrounds. So even though they're very shortly displaced, they might look like they're longer displaced just because of this issue. So just to say that we account for these things. All right, so background. So what we need to achieve, as I told you, is in order to get down to 1 kilohertz, we need suppression of 10 to the minus 4, roughly. So there are three main backgrounds that we are considering. So one are fakes. This is the most challenging one, especially as a theorist, because you really don't know what you're doing. But if you work with people who know the CMS setup, so like Yuri, they'll tell you that the expectation is for the high luminosity LHC environment that you have roughly 30 fake tracks per event, roughly, if you relax the requirement of pointing to the beamline. So that means that if half of these are plus, half of these are minus, you have roughly 225 fake vertices per event a priori without doing anything. So I started off with 10 to the minus 4 suppression, but I really need 10 to the minus 6 in order to be in business. And this is just some stuff on how we simulate this. So we just throw uniform distributions in the different track parameters, and then we see if a track is reconstructed or not. If a track is reconstructed, we keep it. If not, we keep trying until we have, on average, 30 tracks per event. And this is just to show that there's a correlation between the track radius and the zero of the track. So which I would expect from geometry.
I would have thought you would have started. These are muons, right? I thought you would have started with the muon requirement at the beginning to remove most of the fake tracks.
Yeah, so I will put in a muon requirement, but I'm putting it in at the end. But yeah, there will be a muon requirement. And it's necessary, right? Okay. Yeah. So the hope is to use that as little as possible, so you can do other signals too. But it's not feasible to do it without a muon requirement.
But if you did start with the muon requirement, that you remove most of these fakes.
Yes, you do remove most of these fakes. The issue with that, from our point of view for this toy simulation, is it's not something we can reliably simulate, right? So it's a fudge factor that we're going to assume at the end. And so we sort of want to show, like, this is how far you can get without assuming this. And then, you know, the argument will be the fudge factor that you need on top of that is considered reasonable from what you would naively.
Okay.
Yeah. But like just assuming it from the start would sort of, yeah, it would. I think it would make a less credible case for what we're doing. Yeah, and then similarly you have k longs, k shorts decaying, and again like there we can get rid of most of these by asking for muons because they decay to pions usually. And then b mesons make a lot of muons, and so there we're going to have to cut on the radius in order to get rid of these guys. All right, so there's some weird thing that happened with these plots. So this white band doesn't mean anything, I'm sorry. So it's just focus on the, this is the signal, this is the background, this is the vertex, this is some vertex quality requirements that I talked about before. This is the distance in the z direction between the two tracks at the point where they intersect in the transverse plane. So this gives you a measure on, for the signal vertices, this is very small because you have a true vertex. If you just have combinatorial background from random tracks, this is flat. So we cut on this, and that gives us roughly two orders of magnitude suppression. So we get back the penalty that we paid in the previous slide. The other thing that we need to do is we need to require that if you compute the momentum of the mother particle of the muons, that it points back to the beamline. That will also really reduce. It's a bit of a cost for signal models in some sense, because some models will not satisfy this. But for the model that we are looking at, it works. And it's a really good discriminator also for fakes. So that's what you're seeing over here. This is the angle of the mother particle's trajectory with the beamline. And so you're cutting really hard on this, again, giving you two orders of magnitude suppression of the fakes. So after doing these things, this is the number of vertices that you have left per event from fakes and from chaos. Subject to a couple different sets of PT cuts on the outgoing particles. And you see we have roughly, you know, still something like 100 kilohertz worth of rate. In order to get rid of this, now we require, as you pointed out earlier, that these things actually correspond to muons, right? And then the assumption is that one of these particles faking a muon, the probability of that is less than, if that's less than roughly 1 in 50 per track, then you know you would be in business. But we don't really know this number for a fact. We can't really reliably simulate it, so that's why we do a couple different PT cuts to sort of mitigate this uncertainty a little bit.
150 is a bit optimistic.
It's optimistic, you think?
Yeah. For 2GV?
Yeah.
2GV, yeah, this one is not really, we don't actually make a projection for this one. I mean, also your muons are barely making it out at that point, right?
So this one
is just to show you like how the rate scales as a function of PT cuts, but like we really only consider the others as, I have plots for the others, but not for the 2GB one. Okay, and then finally I need to cut on the vertex radius to get rid of Bs. And the cut is roughly 1.5 centimeters with this, because of the smearing.
You get a lot of bees that travel that far in pairs of muons.
Yes, so I simulate it, reconstruct it, and yeah, so yeah. I mean, again, like I'm trying to get down to a kilohertz, I'm not trying to be background free in there. In real life, you'll have to do more things offline to do an actual search. All right, so this is the full cut flow. These are the quality cuts that I said before. This is the cut for the B mesons, and then I also cut on the impact parameters. I, of course, want to exclude prompt tracks. Otherwise, I'm just swamped, right? All right, so this is the final result. So what you're seeing here as a function of the lifetime in the rest frame, so this is the proper lifetime of this particle, and this is the yield. This is the number of events that you would collect at the high luminosity LHC, divided by the branching ratio of B to this thing, and then the particle to muons, just the total branching ratio. So in other words, if all the branching ratios were 1, this is how many particles you could collect. And so it's plotted this way so that we can compare with what LHCb could be doing, right? So they, again, have like less acceptance. They have less luminosity, but they have very, very low PT cuts, like 0.5 GeV muons they can see with a momentum of 10 GeV. It's pretty remarkable. And so that really helps them a lot. And so in the short lifetime regime, they do better because they don't have this requirement on the lifetime to get rid of the B mesons. So what you're seeing here is this is the LHCb yield. This is a yield if you just put in a 2 10 GeV muons, a standard optimistic but standard trigger. And this is the yield curves for the most optimistic case, the 3 GeV, a bit more pessimistic, you take 4 4 4 or 5 3, which are these others.
If you apply a very stringent delta R cut, or reasonably stringent delta R cut, you can go much lower than 10 GeV, I think.
But the muons can trigger.
So the two muons are close to each other, so within, say, delta R 1.4 or something like that. That's what's done for some of the scouting streams.
Yeah, so the scouting stream is basically, I mean, it's 4.5 GeV PT cut as well, right? So it's roughly the same ballpark.
About 4.5 at HLT, not level 1.
Yes.
So level 1 is like, I don't know, what's the cut? It's 1 GeV or something?
3.5? 3.
Yeah, it's
a 1 G. I think it takes 2.5 GeV to just get to.
Just to get there, yeah.
Sure, but level 1 resolution is bad enough that you don't want to apply for PT selection, even if it does have a PT. I think for some periods, the work cuts that maybe aren't used at level 1 were like incredibly low.
Me too, not.
Right. I don't know, I just saw this. There's a thumb in the butt somewhere.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But, yeah. Once you allow them to be displaced, though, then probably that threshold doesn't help. I don't think you could do better than 10.
This is sort of just like a straw man thing that I.
What is this? I cannot read the CQC tau scale. Right? How far out you go?
This is in centimeters, and this is basically prompt. This is like a 0.1 millimeter, and it goes down. It goes out to a meter. But then you can just extrapolate these curves, right? They're just linear in this regime all the way.
This is the C-tau. Sorry, but your acceptance is the C-tau
in
the detector, there must be some efficiency that dies
out. It dies after 30 centimeters because you don't have enough stops anymore. Yeah. Right. I have a plot, but I don't think I put it in
the scouting dies out at 10 centimeters.
Yeah. Anyway, so the scouting, I think, is for sure competitive for this. But at the time, you hadn't put out your paper yet, I think. The advantage of this would be that you'd read out the whole event, right? And so you can look at it later.
And the LHCb line is like LHCb now?
I mean, this is their projection for Hailumi. I mean, their selection, at least at the trigger level right now, well, they don't have a level 1 trigger anymore after this run. They're so... lose already for this stuff. There's little they can really gain other than collecting a lot of data. Yeah. Someone else had a question there.
So this is how far out in ADA do you go?
2.4.
Okay. Because I think at higher ADA, the problem here is these muons, these are low PT.
Right.
And that problem arises, has two effects. One is low PT, low momentum muons don't make it to the muon chambers.
Right.
The other one is local scattering is a real problem.
Yes.
As you go forward, both of those problems are fixed because the momentum goes up even though the PT is
right.
Have you separated out the forward muon system from the central muon system to see if there's an easier route in the forward direction? Easier to compete with LUCD at the lower?
You mean without making use of the track trigger and just using a regular muon trigger?
Maybe relying more on the regular muon trigger.
Because my understanding is that you don't have a track trigger out of at a larger than 2.4, right? Is that correct?
Right, but I mean out to 2.4. So between 1.5 and 2.4.
Ah, okay,
there's a lot more momentum for the same PT, and a lot of the challenges like the local scattering just go down fast. And the muons will penetrate and you might be able to have a level one, dimuon level one trigger.
Maybe.
That feeds a much less stringent track.
Yeah, so then you define a region of interest with the muon chamber, and then you only look at that part in the track.
Yeah.
I see.
Because I think you showed that have multiple scattering and
it's
a real problem.
Yeah. Right.
That's going to go down pretty fast as you go forward just because the momentum goes up quite a bit. By a factor of three or so, two or three.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it's part of what I think LHCB's strength is, right? That they have high momentum, even though they're low.
Yeah, they're basically, the momentum cut of this is, the momentum cut is 10 GeV or so. And so that barely cost them, that cost them like a factor of two in signal acceptance or something. It's very, very small.
Sorry, if I understand this graph correctly, you're saying that your optimistic estimate can only do five times better, it's an order one improvement on what an ATB can do, right?
Yeah, right, that's what I'm saying, yeah.
Okay.
You might not be impressed by that.
No,
the statement that I'm making is that CMS could be potentially could be competitive with LHCb. Now, the uncertainties on these numbers, because this is just a toy study that we're doing, is large enough that I don't even want to claim that CMS automatically does better.
Right.
Or worse, you're potentially competitive with LHCb, I think is the politically correct way of phrasing this. Obviously CMS has a bunch of advantages, even if you have the same acceptance, has a bunch of advantages compared to LHCb in the sense that, you can do missing energy, you can reconstruct the rest of the event and so on.
Right.
So I'm just looking at this random B-meson, not so random, but like a B-meson example, but if you have some more involved model, you might want to see what's on the other side of the event. Which brings me to my last slide, which is things that we're trying to do now. So the same tricks, now that we have set up our simulation framework, we can try to look for a displaced muon pair with some missing energy, see if we can bring down the MET trigger with some interesting amount. So in this case, we relax the pointing, but instead require for maybe 50 GV worth of mass or something along those lines. We're hoping to, we're exploring as a multi-track trigger where we're asking for four or more tracks and we don't require them to be muons, but now because there's four tracks in the vertex, your fake rate goes down, and so there might be another avenue of getting out. Or you can look for maybe a pair of these things. And so these are all different variations on the same idea that we're trying to work out, and so we're hoping to explore in a bit more generality, if you had this capability, what additional physics reach can you have at high luminosity LHCs? Unfortunately, I don't have any results for this yet.
At the beginning of the talk, you said that in order to do this, it requires more hard work. What are you talking about?
I don't know in detail. I think the baseline design, as I was being told, this is requiring that the tracks are pointing back to the fit of the tracks of the stubs.
That's something that it's programmable.
It's programmable.
I guess you need more programming.
You need more units. Yeah. I don't know. That's a study that one needs to do here.
Yuri must have been here.
Yeah, I think Yuri has some sense, and he thinks that it's not cheap, but it's not, you know, the order of hundreds of millions of dollars, of course. But it's an investment. I mean, it's not something that I think you can just sneak in without anyone noticing. That's my understanding.
I have to review the trigger we got the next one.
I see, yeah. they're hopefully much more qualified to answer that question than I am. All right, that's all I have. So yeah, any more questions or anything else you want to discuss, we can do that.
Do you think there's any prospect of using the bparking data set to do this kind of search?
So let's see, if I recall correctly, the bparking is, you ask for a displaced muon BT of 8 GeV, is that right? Last time I looked at it. I haven't carefully looked at bparking yet. To first order, I would say, yeah, you will be able to do something. I mean, you have 10 to the 10 B is just, you know, there, right, on the other side of the event, even regardless of the one that you're
tagging. That's what I was thinking of, but yeah, it's also the displacement.
But, like, it's immediately 5 orders of magnitude compared to the baseline rate, right? So, of course, here we also have this penalty. Well, we can actually compare, right? So, right now, so here we have, like, you know, in the most optimistic scenario, you have, like, 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 12 that you'd record, right? And so the bparking right now, you have 10 to the 10. So assuming that you can keep doing this at the same rate, and you can collect 10 to the 12 of them for high luminosity LHC, I'm not sure that this is feasible, right? Because presumably if pileup goes up, the parking will become harder.
Yeah, but can we compare the parking now with the LHCb limit now?
Yeah, so good. So yeah, that's a good point. Let's go back to the LHCb.
But we have data on tape and people.
Right.
Willing to announce.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that I somewhat more recently learned some more details about the parking. I think it's super fascinating. It's super cool. I just haven't had a chance of looking at it, right? So, okay, so here you see the limit. The branching ratio is 6 times this number, right? And so they have, what, 10 to the 12 Bs that I made, roughly, in total. So branching ratio is 10 to the minus 7. So that means that their efficiency is 10 to the 10,
I thought.
10 to the 10, LHCb?
CMS is
10
to the 10.
10 to the 10, away from the trigger one.
Yeah.
Yeah, for CMS, yes. But so I was trying to game out the LHCb number, right? So from this, you can sort of guesstimate that the LHCb efficiency, signal efficiency, is something to 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, right? So that's a small number, right? So if you,
exactly, yeah.
So even though they have more Bs than you have in your parked data set, it's not inconceivable that you could do better. It just depends on what background, yeah, how good you are at rejecting your backgrounds. But your detector is bigger than theirs, right? The velo is fairly small. So you can always try to go out further in lifetime and just get rid of the BMS on background. They're getting rid of the BMS on background by doing this full reconstruction and so on and so on.
Yeah.
So you might be competitive. I don't know. It's a non-obvious question. So we're looking now, you know, we're doing a study on whether we can do this with your data scouting data set, which I think is pretty nice. So I think you might be competitive.
Yeah, that's good. The issue with anything where you trigger on the displaced thing is that the PT measurement of the displaced thing at level 1 is biased because it takes a vertex constraint for now. That will change in the future. It's interesting to see if you can do it without any trigger problems at all. Right. You know, just triggering on the other feed.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean the park data set, I think,
in
is
the scouting that constraint was removed. Or level 1.
Level 1, I'm saying.
But that level, the HLT, that constraint was removed.
Yeah, well, HLT is not a problem, it's a level 1.
You're just scaring me from you.
Wasn't there a level 1 open muon trigger where the PT is basically just not measured? All you're saying is that there is a PT.
It's heavy per scale.
That plus something else.
There's a mass bin.
Yeah, maybe, was there a die level 1 open?
It was for a while when we were trying to do B physics, I mean, J size and Upsilon's, but then I don't know what happened to that.
That's why I was asking earlier about the sketching, because I thought they used Delta R to kill the backgrounds rather than using the PTs. You have two muons, but you just require them to be close to each other rather than...
There is delta R cut. Yeah, I remember that. I don't know how much it does. Yeah. Yeah, so we haven't, yeah, we haven't used the delta R cut. That's in principle. Yeah, I don't know how much that would help for... Yeah, you have to think about it.
So at the end of your level one trigger requirements, you got a number, which I assume was for a rate that was So what was the ballpark rate and the efficiency, the level one trigger efficiency?
Good. So the ballpark rate was the order of like something like a kilohertz. That's what we're shooting for. Well, it depends crucially on this muon, the muon matching, how much that buys you, right? And I have a plot, but it's not in my backup slides for some reason, about the efficiency, so I can draw it and I can show it to you later if you want. So this is as a function of the truth level vertex radius. So this is a plot made for theorists, right? Because this is what we can cut on, and so that's why I plotted it in this way, where I required a PT of the two muons at truth level again, above 4 GeV. So subject to this constraint, the curve looks something like this, where this is, let's say, 2 centimeters, and this is roughly 30 centimeters. This is just when you run out of tracker, and it saturates roughly at 0.9 or so. So after you pay this penalty, it's fairly efficient. That's the upshot.
What's the cost of that? The PT greater than 4 basically, I think, means at low masses you lose only.
It's fairly mass independent. It depends on the, because the boost is basically given by the B. Right, so the mass of the only thing that the mass of the actual particle is doing is determining the opening angle, right? And so it does have a bit of an effect over here, in the sense that like you might misreconstruct the location of the vertex and it might fall outside your selection.
Okay.
So that's where, and here also the two different mass points are slightly different for some subtle reasons, but this curve is roughly independent on the mass of the particle. So it is for half a GV and a 2 GV guy, it doesn't make a huge difference.
So you keep most, I mean, 90% is good.
And yeah, subject to the strict level constraint, which is the most costly constraint.
So let's thank Simon.